Chapter 3 Mortlock looked up from a book as I came back into my cabin. His eyes blinked a little readily, for it was clear that he'd been asleep, or nearly so, until the moment of my return. The volume in question, Woodville's Medical Botany, sat precariously in Mortlock's fingers, nearly upside down, and only a twitch away from falling to the hard, varnished floor.
"The pictures are very pretty, Doctor. I've never seen a book so nice."
"Nor so expensively procured, Mortlock. So kindly return it to the shelf before it succumbs to catastrophe." I softened my words with a smile. "You are welcome to come here and read whenever it suits you, but I think it would help to be awake while doing so. Furthermore, most scholars agree that Woodville is best appreciated the right way up."
"Oh!"
Mortlock fumbled the book around in his lap, then closed it delicately.
"I didn't shut my eyes for more than a moment, I promise. I said I'd keep a watch on the coronel, and I meant it."
"Your diligence is not remotely in question. How has he been?"
"Quiet as a mouse for the most part. Mumbles something now and then, but we all do that when we're sleeping, don't we?"
"Unconsciousness manifests itself in varying degrees. A word here and there is no cause for concern. He seemed comfortable in himself? No convulsing?"
"Not a twitch. He's sleeping like a babe, I'd say. You put him right with that froggy drill."
"It was not without risk, but I dare say it was the only action that would have saved him." I made a gesture of gentle encouragement in the direction of the door. "You may leave with my thanks. I will mention to von Voot that you have been of particular assistance. Though you are off duty, you may wish to go on deck. They have found the elusive break in the line of cliffs. The fissure, Master Topolsky calls it."
"The fissure? Fishing for what?"
"Fissure, not fissure. A narrow passage which may allow us to reach an inland sea, a sort of lagoon, I suppose, although that word does not sit well with these freezing latitudes."
"All this way for more sea?"
"I gather there is something of interest in the lagoon itself, although Master Topolsky would not say too much. Perhaps if we are lucky, we will soon see it with our own eyes. There is talk of fortunes to be made, so I gather it must be something out of the ordinary."
"Pardon me for saying so, Doctor, but you don't strike me as the sort out to make a fortune."
"I am not, Mortlock. I shall consider myself amply rewarded if I have served this ship and crew satisfactorily, and we make it back with the minimum of casualties."
"That'd do me as well, if I'm honest."
He paused a moment.
"Well, if you don't mind, I'll take my leave and see what's going on with this fishing."
"Fisher, Mortlock. Fishing is a very different process. When I was certain that the midshipman was in no danger of returning, I allowed myself a pinch of opium to restore the clarity of my thoughts, then scraped my chair around so that I could sit comfortably at the side of Coronel Ramos. I lifted the bandage away from the area where I had cut into his scalp, satisfying myself that the expulsion of blood had ceased and that there was no suppuration of concern. I had not meant to disturb Ramos from his sleep, but he must have been closer to awareness than I guessed, for his eyelids fluttered and a word emerged from his lips.
"Doctor,"
I answered softly.
"Yes, Coronel. Please be still. You are in my cabin. There was an accident."
"An accident?"
"Yes, a few hours ago. You were on deck and..." He did not open his eyes.
"Am I maimed?"
"No, you are quite intact in body and limb. But you did suffer severe concussion. I had to open your skull to relieve the pressure. Please do not be alarmed."
"I have seen worse things done to men, and I have seen men survive worse things."
With the mild interest of someone inquiring after next week's weather, he added,
"Will I leave?"
"I think it very likely, but you must rest for now." For a man of such stature, and whose hairless, heavy-jawed head was so imposing, the coronel had remarkably gentle eyes. They opened now, degree by degree.
"You drilled into me. I did. He chuckled once.
I have been sliced, stabbed, and penetrated by shot. Sometimes by the enemies of Hidalgo, and sometimes by his friends. Twice by the husbands of his friends. But never drilled until now.
I had no choice.
You need not explain yourself. If you did it to me, then I know that it was necessary.
He reached against his restraints, striving to touch my hand. I closed my fingers around his.
I thank you, Silas. Not only for saving my life, which I am sure that you did, but for giving me another story to tell.
I would think a man who had lived your life would have stories enough.
Yeah, there are many, it is true. But I have never found it easy to speak in the company of other men. I have nothing to say to men who speak only of whoring and drinking. But if I have a story to tell, I am sometimes able to feel the silence. There have been many silences and many stories. Another is always welcome.
Then I am glad to have been of service. But I will insist that you rest.
I will rest. But first, what happened to me?
A block of wood, do not ask me its function, came down from the rigging.
Better that we sail on steam, as in your book.
I was pleased that he remembered, for it indicated little or no loss of recent memory. For now, we must confine ourselves to reality. Coronel, may I ask something?
I could deny you nothing, Silas.
You were talking in your sleep. You said trethe, which I think is 13, and another word was thinko, which I believe is 5. 13 and 5 several times. Do these numbers have some significance? He shook that massive head.
I do not think so. Perhaps in my sleep I was wagering. My father tried to beat it out of me, but if there was a way to gamble, I have always found it, even in my dreams. I have won and lost 1,000 fortunes while abed.
There is one other thing.
Please.
You said La Vigilia de Piedra, the Vigil of Stone, or the Stone Vigil. He tried to lift his head.
I did.
It is an odd thing to say. It is the title of my narrative, or at least the title I have presently assigned it. But I have mentioned that title to no one. Mortlock saw it just now when he was nosing through my belongings. Ramos made to stir as if duty called him.
He has betrayed your trust?
No, no, not at all. I placed a calming hand on his chest. Mortlock is kind and well-intentioned, and he insisted on watching over you when I was on deck. Mortlock is not the mystery. The mystery is the similarity between my title and the words you uttered.
I have not looked upon your narrative.
No, and not for one instant did I imagine you had. But if the words are familiar to you in your native tongue, then it must betoken something. The originality I thought was mine cannot be so. Where do those words come from, Coronel? He looked at me, his eyes open and truthful.
I do not know, Silas.
You have no recollection?
I do not. Not of the numbers, not of the words. I do not think it is a story or a song or a poem. I have never remembered such things before, so why?
He paused.
There is someone you could ask, Silas. Someone among us who knows everything about words.
Milady Carseel. I nearly laughed. Dear Coronel, if it came to that, I should sooner drill into my own skull and keep going. It was late. Much later than was usually the custom. But in view of the discovery now upon us, Captain von Voot had called Demeter's senior figures to his stateroom. No meal was to be served at this exceptional hour, but sherry and cigars had been set before each place, and Master Topolsky was already making very commendable inroads into both his glass and his cigar. His eyes red, his cheeks inflamed, and his mood ebullient to the point of boisterousness.
"Savor this evening, gentlemen,"
he was declaiming loudly as I came into the room.
"It will be the last before your lives are changed utterly. Tomorrow we cross the Rubicon."
He paused to fan away his own gauze of cigar smoke.
"We stand on the threshold of eternity. Our names will be uttered in the company of Polo, Magellan, and Columbus. Mere cartographers like Cook, Mason, and Dixon will be swept into the annals of deserved obscurity."
"Perhaps," von Voot said mildly, attempting to temper his client while remaining within the bounds of civility.
"Perhaps a little caution is in order, Master Topolsky, until we have completed a thorough survey of the passage by daylight."
"Captain," Topolsky said amiably, "I know you far too well, dear fellow. You are a man of passions, a man of boldness. You will not be daunted by a modest constriction of rock and water. Yes, by all means conduct your survey. I'm sure these things must be seen to be done. But let us not pretend that by this time tomorrow Demeter will be anywhere but the other side of the fissure."
"Shilish," von Voot said in a companionable manner, inviting me to take the seat that he had kept vacant by his side.
"Is the news all that we might hope for concerning our dear friend from the Americas?"
"Yes, Doctor,"
inquired Herr Brucker, the owlish instrument maker. He was completely bald, save for a narrow stripe of black hair running from crown to nape, just as if it had been applied by a single stroke from a tar brush.
"The news is good, ja?"
"Coronel Ramos is awake and lucid," I reported.
"Excellent,"
said Lieutenant Henry Murgatroyd, the second most senior man on the ship. He thumped the table and encouraged a general round of thumping, clapping, and toasting. "I have urged him to rest," I said, smiling at the party. "It is my fervid hope that he will make a full recovery, but there is still peril in the coming days. However, Coronel Ramos is as strong a man as I have known, and it is my expectation that he will rally."
"Did you mean fervent hope?"
asked Milady Cossil.
"It is true that the two words are commonly taken to be interchangeable by those of modest learning, but they are not exact synonyms."
"Are they not?" I asked, feigning sincere interest.
"Fervid may be said to imply a degree of unreasoning feeling beyond mere intensity of desire. A man of scientific inclination would adhere to the use of fervent unless he wished his fellows to think him possessed by irrationality."
"I would not want that," I said, with the quiet satisfaction of one who has set a trap and seen it sprung.
"Please, milady," said Murgatroyd, leaning over to pour a little more sherry into her glass. "The doctor has had a trying evening. Perhaps his education could be adjourned temporarily."
"If we will not educate ourselves, Lieutenant, then we must depend on the kindness of others."
She took a delicate nip of the sherry.
"But you are right. It must be a very tedious business to see a man helped towards the light when he is not willing to be led."
"Perhaps the man wishes only to find the light for himself," I answered. "But your kind efforts are noted, milady." Before she could get in a rejoinder, I said immediately, "Captain von Voot, is it indeed the case that we have found the inlet?"
"All the drawings agree, Shilish, although there is only so much we can see by moonlight. It should be navigable, I think. Master Topolsky tells me that Europa was broader of beam than Demeter and heavier of draught, although I do not know the ship for myself. We will observe the tidal flow in the morning and judge for ourselves when it is best to thread the needle. I think we will go with the tide if we have the wind at our backs. Before we do that, though, perhaps we may speak more openly of what the expedition expects to find besides a lagoon. There was a need for secrecy when we were putting in and out of port, but that time has now surely passed."
Dupin glanced at Topolsky and received a nod of assent. The young cartographer had cleared a space before him on the table and unrolled a chart that I did not think I had seen before.
He weighted its curling edges down with cutlery.
"Explain, please, for the benefit of our hosts," Topolsky said, puffing vigorously on his cigar with one hand, scratching at the oiled, perfumed mass of his beard with the other.
"It's the lagoon,"
Dupin said, his voice breaking on the words. He was sweating profusely, his complexion clammy. The sharp angles of his face stood out as if chiselled.
"That we may charitably have deduced for ourselves," said Murgatroyd.
He was a well-bred Irishman whose handsome countenance had not been greatly diminished by the loss of an eye to the Americans. He now wore a patch and seemed to compensate for the absent eye by injecting a surfeit of expression into the other. No man on Demeter was better able to communicate his feelings through so limited a vessel, even if it were achieved with the merest narrowing of his lids or the slightest telling aversion of gaze. He was loyal to Von Foot, and still more loyal to the ship, which I think he fancied was due to become his in turn. Of our expeditionary guests, he regarded them as one might regard some troublesome but profitable cargo, an annoyance which must be tolerated, even pampered, in the interests of later reward. He did not like any of the guests, except the absent Ramos, and his seniority allowed him the privilege of not masking his sentiments. In his defense, his animadversion owed nothing to nationality or creed. We were not presently at war with anyone, and so our motley assortment of Russians, English, French, and Spaniards, if Ramos was still to be considered subject to Spain, were accorded excellent indifference. Master Topolsky jabbed his half-consumed cigar in the general direction of Dupin's chart, allowing hot sparks to rain down on the drawing.
"Observe, please, the general shape of the feature, as that will have an important bearing on what we may expect to see by daylight. Note the shape of the lagoon, firstly how it extends inland and to the east by about 6 miles, never more than a mile across, but also how it bends gradually to the south, describing an arc or sickle. Note also the prominence jutting out from the southern shore, which will hinder any direct sighting of the lagoon's easterly limit."
"Which is where you expect to find this fortress?" I asked, noting a small, black, spider-like impression which lay on the chart at the rightmost extent of the lagoon.
"Edifice, we are calling it, ja?" replied Brooker.
And the emphasis in his reply caused me to capitalize the word in my imagination, as if it had unique significance and stature. Not merely an edifice, but the edifice. "Edifice, then," I replied.
"And what are these curious lines?"
I gestured at a net of curving marks, enclosing the lagoon like wood grain around a knot.
"Contours of elevation," Dupin said, using a trembling hand to flick the cigar sparks aside. "An innovation of Aton's from his work on Chelion."
He dabbed perspiration from his brow.
"Along each line, the height above the sea remains constant."
He coughed, spit dappling the table like the first drops of a rainstorm.
"Where the lines are closest..."
"Are you feeling quite well, Monsieur Dupin?" I interjected.
"The boy is simply a little overworked," Topolsky said. "Instead of loafing around in his cabin, he has been on that deck with his spyglass for 3 continuous watches."
"Then he needs to rest," I regarded the young man sternly. "You will rest, Remo." He sniffed. His grey-green eyes regarded me.
"I was telling you about the contour lines."
"Yes, and I appreciated your explanation." I smiled, wanting the boy to know that I only had his best interests at heart. "And I see it now. The lines get very close at the near end of the lagoon, where the cliffs must be nearly vertical. Then the slope becomes less severe on the opposing shores, but it becomes very steep again near this mark. This is your fortress. I'm sorry. Edifice."
"It is."
"It looks like a fat furry-legged spider or a little black octopus. These arms are defensive fortifications? Walls, trenches, or such like? Frowning, I reached across to tap a nail against the chart. The lagoon is drawn to scale.
Naturally, Dupin said.
Then if the lagoon is, as you say, a full 6 miles from end to end, 6 miles from the fissure to the eastern limit, then this black mark must be a quarter of a mile across.
I shall astonish you further. The men of Europa reported that the fortress was as tall as it was broad.
Topolsky pressed his face nearer mine, so that I got a full, heady waft of his perfumed oils.
Imagine it, Code. A pile of stones sufficient to render the pyramids mere pimples on the pustulant face of Egypt. Does that not stir the soul? Even your soul?
I suppose it does. I might also wonder who made this thing and whether they are at all inclined to be visited. Topolsky dismissed my qualms with a flick of his wrist.
No hint of life moves in those walls. In all probability, our quarry has lain empty and desolate for hundreds of years, forgotten to time. Its purpose, even the hand that commanded it to be built, lost to fathomless antiquity. We may disturb dust and ghosts, but little else.
His twinkling, sherry-tinted eyes roved over my face, searching for the fundamental flaw of character that he surely knew to be present.
Dear God, man, are you not in the least part moved by such a prospect?
I am neither moved nor unmoved, I admitted. If you had resolved the riddle of heredity of physiognomy, or devised a lens for discerning bone through living tissue, or shown me how to render a patient insensible to the agony of surgery, I might be moved in the manner you expect.
Your indifference will crumble at the first glimpse of those soaring fortifications, Topolsky assured me. But in the meantime, let me appeal to somewhat baser instincts.
I smiled.
By all means. What we find here will make all of us very famous and very wealthy.
I desire neither.
Herr Brucker looked doubtful. A judicious smile creased Milady Cossille's lips. She had extracted a yellow feather from her hat and was tickling the side of her mouth as she examined me.
Then I assume you will be publishing your manuscript pseudonymously, and with all royalties redirected to the destitute?
She asked. I will not be publishing it, milady. It is abundantly plain that the work is beyond salvation.
That would be a very great disappointment, Doctor.
I am surprised that you feel that way, milady. At every turn you seem to have found more fault than good. Milady Cossille looked about the other guests, her face a mask of wild surprise.
But I thought my criticisms perfectly timid, generous even.
She consulted the instrument maker.
Would you not concur, Herr Brucker?
Brucker blinked and answered in the manner of one very much inclined not to cause trouble.
Always generous, yeah.
Perhaps you thought your observations generous, I said. The others put on tense smiles and feigned an awkward interest in their sherry glasses and half-spent cigars. Herr Brucker rubbed at the improbable stripe of his hair. Murgatroyd scratched an itch under his eye patch. The ship creaked and the waves slapped against her sides. Milady Cossille would not be deflected.
Have they not helped you improve the narrative in certain regards?
I had to fight hard to contain my anger. I had tried to draw Milady's venom with the deliberate usage of fervid, knowing she would pounce. That achieved, I had hoped to be spared any more of her criticism, at least for that evening.
Improve things?
They have compelled me to go back and redraft passages, if that's what you mean. You did not agree with the type of ship my adventurers employed, so, perforce, I had to amend it. You said there were deficiencies in my depiction of the customs of shipboard life, a misunderstanding of elementary matters of navigation and rank, and so I tried to improve those areas.
You said that I had the weather quite wrong for the specified time of year, and that the winds I described were absurdly unrealistic for the given circumstances.
Lady Cossille nodded encouragement.
But all of these alterations have been to the betterment of your tale, Dr. Coad.
It is a fact, nonetheless, that each change had consequence. My story has become clotted, overburdened with detail, and forced to explain that which needed no clarification. Thanks to your interventions, I am spending as much time redrafting as pushing forward. Judging by her pretty frown, she found my answer perfectly bewildering.
But if the story were constructed on dubious foundations, was it not better to shore them up now rather than continuing to build an ever less stable structure?
You may see it in that light, milady. All I know is that I cannot now proceed. I looked around the table. Please, dear friends, let us speak no more of my vanity. There is, besides, another reason why I must discontinue. My cheeks tingled. It is an awkward thing to discuss, but in light of this evening, I would have no choice but to abandon the narrative completely.
What has happened, Silas?
Asked von Voot. I stirred in my seat, uneasy under the inquisition of my peers. My clothes felt sticky, my eyes itchy with the after effects of opium and sherry. I had a certain direction in mind, I said, an objective towards which the story was racing. That objective was a structure of forbidding proportions, what you might almost term an edifice.
What good tale doesn't have a big old castle in it? Asked Murgatroyd cheerfully.
It is not just that, Henry. We have followed my characters over water to the brink of their first glimpse of the castle. Edifice. Unconsciously, I was capitalizing the word just as surely as Herr Brooker had done. They were about to be stirred and daunted, torn between a terror of the sublime unknown and their craving for notoriety. The latter impulse compelled them to enter this edifice, whereupon I shook my head, thoroughly dispirited, not even willing to continue my own thought.
Whereupon what, Gold? Topolsky probed.
Events of a disturbing nature were to befall them.
You can't give up on this story, Doctor, pleaded Mortlock. For the men downstairs, if not for us. We're just getting good, sir. I mean, not that the earlier bits weren't good as well, they were, but now it was getting proper interesting. Oh, for king and country, sir, don't have me reading to the men from Swift and Defoe again.
I lifted my sherry glass to him, tipped it deferentially. You are kind, Mortlock. A sudden gripping anxiety had me desperate to leave the room at any cost. Dear friends, I must attend to the coronel. I have left him alone for far too long. I turned to the clammy-faced boy. Raymond, may I count on you to take some rest? You are in urgent need of it.
See to the brute,
Topolsky said, as if we were speaking of a useful dog or pack mule.
I'll see that Dupin rests. But before you depart, Code, you must satisfy our curiosity in one respect.
By all means, I said guardedly, beginning to rise from my chair.
What were the events of a disturbing nature?
I did not answer him. I could not have done so had I wished. Although I knew that the events set to before my characters were in all respects abhorrent, and that in some sense I had already devised these horrors in my mind with dramatic foreshadowing, I could not at that moment bring a single facet of those vile consequences to mind. It was as if I did not wish to remember what had already happened to those poor souls. Chapter 4 Ramos stirred as I loosened his restraints, satisfied that he was not likely to do himself harm before morning.
Where have you been, Silas? Surely you shall be sleepy.
I will sleep now, Coronel. I rubbed at my stinging eyes. I have been up to the captain's stateroom. You know of the inlet your employer has been searching for?
I knew of his folly.
You didn't believe in it? I poured him some water and offered it to his lips. I would have thought it a prerequisite for being in Master Topolsky's service.
Not so, dear Silas. Master Topolsky demanded of me only that I swear to serve him in matters of security, contract law, and such military expertise as may be called upon. This you know very well. Your captain is an honorable man, and I think fair in his relations, but we do have a contract with him, and I am to remind him of the terms, should our opinions vary.
And enforce those terms if needed?
I think a persuasive word would be sufficient. Hidalgo achieved far more with words than gunpowder, and I try to walk in that man's shadow.
He looked ruefully down the length of his body, still lying on the table where we had operated.
Besides, I am but one on a ship of hundreds, and now I have a hole in my head. The men below are not soldiers, but I would not wish to make enemies of one of them.
Nor they you, Colonel. I began to undress while I still had the energy to do so. But, for what it is worth, the folly is real. Dupin has found the fissure, that is what they keep calling it, and if our Dutchman is satisfied, then tomorrow we will sail through it into the body of water now screened from us by cliffs. I suppose you know of the fortification Topolsky expects to find at the eastern end of the lagoon? Brooker called it the edifice?
I know only that I may be called to find a way into it.
Do you believe it will exist?
I did not believe that we will find this inlet. Now that we have, I am ready to accept the rest of it.
He paused.
But my involvement remains practical. As we near the edifice, I will advise on safe lines of approach. If he wishes that we shall blast our way in, I will advise in the setting of powder. When we are within, I shall guard against traps. The nature of the thing is a problem for other men.
He thinks it could make your fortune.
If he's right, the money will be of help to my friends in New Spain. And one day, perhaps, if their enterprise succeeds, I shall be able to return to Valladolid without looking over my shoulder. Money can help with that as well.
I sensed the pain it caused him to speak of his own concerns, his eagerness to deflect onto another subject.
What of you, Silas?
What of me? I smiled, having to think for a moment. Even as I did, a sort of picture began to form before my eyes, unfolding itself as colourfully and tantalisingly as a child's paper theatre, made of clever folds and hinges. I should like to return to Plymouth and become a doctor on dry land. A great sceptical crease split the boulder of his forehead.
Not in London. I thought all you Englishmen were drawn to London like flies to guano.
No, Plymouth would suit me well enough, I said, grinning at his understandable misperception. The air is fresher, for one. A view of the sea would suit me, but not too near a view. The picture unfolded itself still further. A modest, white-painted cottage, a little orchard, perhaps even a wife, if she tolerates my daydreaming. I should call it Hilltop Cottage. There would be vines and honeysuckle, and perhaps some fine oaks about. I should like enough patience to balance my books, and sufficient that I may be of some service to the townsfolk, but not so many that they interfere with my writing. Does that seem unreasonable?
I think you are better suited to the sea than you realize.
And I am content that this will be my first and last voyage. I have not been truly happy at any time since we set sail. If I am not seasick, I am cold. If I am not cold, I am exhausted. When I am none of those things, I am frightened. Yet if there is one part of it that I shall not regret, it is our acquaintance.
It is not every friend that drills into another friend's head.
Human affairs would be curious indeed if that were the custom. I praised him again, still as a friend, but through the discerning filter of my surgeon's eyes. Is there anything you feel you need before I retire?
Only that I might satisfy your curiosity concerning that title, La Vigilia de Piedra.
You have traced the source of it? I asked with rising interest.
No, Silas.
He looked at me as fondly and regretfully as a father having to tell his favored son that he could not keep a puppy.
I have searched my memory, and I am as confident as I can be that it means nothing. Nada. It is not a poem or song from my home country, nor a painting, nor anything that I can remember. I must have overheard the words and dreamed them into Spanish.
But not from me.
Men speak things in their sleep, as you have learned. On a ship, it is easy for such things to reach the ears of other men, even if they are themselves asleep. A ship is a dream of whispers.
You mean well, I said kindly, but I am afraid my curiosity is anything but satisfied.
Sleep well, Silas, and in the morning you will be troubled by other things.
I smiled at the austere truth evident in this. Life was indeed a continuous lesson in finding ways to be less troubled by certain things, so that we might make room for new concerns, which arrived with the promptness and regularity of mail coaches. Ramos closed his eyes and became still. For 20 minutes I watched him for signs of agitation, until satisfied that his sleep was agreeable. I ought to have gone straight to my own bed then, but some masochistic compulsion pulled me back to my desk. I opened my manuscript at the last completed page, glared at it in resentment, feeling an equal enmity for the book as I did for the architect of its destruction, the damnable Milady Cassille. I tore out that last page, crumpling it into a ball, and was about to attack the previous one when some wiser instinct stilled my hand. As much as I hated the work, as much as I detested the sin of pride that had seen me embarking on the enterprise, I could not dismiss the good opinion of Mortlock and the midshippers. Perhaps their tastes were not so well formed as that of Milady Cossil and her ilk, but if my words had given those men one moment of respite from the tedium of their lives, what right had I to deprive them of another? I took a pinch from my snuff box and was soon lost to oblivion. I must have fumbled my way to bed, because that was where I woke, with a watery light trembling through the cabin windows where I'd neglected to draw the curtains. A dream was dissipating, like a smoke sculpture being drawn apart by breezes. I'd been wandering that lightless stone tunnel again. The pattern of it was always the same, a stumbling progression through darkness, a hood about my head, until at last I emerged into a chamber where a glimmer of light from above struck against a plane of polished rock, serving as a crude mirror. In the mirror, I glimpsed my hooded reflection, and with a terrible inevitability, I pushed back the hood until the light found the contours of a skull, empty of socket and grinning of jaw, and without fail I moaned or screamed myself to merciful consciousness. I rose, shivering fit to rattle the dream loose from my head. Why did it plague me so? There was ample fuel for nightmares on a ship, so why did I dream of lightless tunnels and hooded skulls instead of drowning or the horrors of battle? I glanced at Ramos, observing the slow, massive rise of his chest, like the earth itself straining, and the peacefulness of his face, as unburdened by worldly concerns as any sleeping saint. My scream must have been the silent kind, for it had not disturbed him. Steadying myself against the rocking of the ship, I washed and dressed, and then chanced to see the crumpled sheet still resting on my desk. Crumpled, but not bald, as if it had been patiently unrolled and flattened while I slept. With a gathering unease, I sat in my chair and took the crumpled sheet between my fingers, flattening it further. My words were as I remembered them, right up to the point where the flow deserted me and my pen dabbed a line of expectant dots, the roots from which words might flower when once again inspiration had me in its thrall. But those words were not the entirety of the torn sheet. In larger, bolder strokes, cutting mercilessly across the prior text, three words had been blotted down. Inversion. Inversion. Eversion. I stared at the rude adornment, noting how the ink skipped and snagged its way across the ruts and creases in the paper, indicating that it had been made after I balled up the page. I glanced again at Ramos, entertaining for an instant the notion that he might have risen from his recuperation and scrawled this palimpsest across my work. But in truth, I already knew well the author of the crime. The hand was mine and mine alone. At some point between my last clear recollection and waking, I had unrolled the ball and set my pen to it again. Some delirium of the small hours, fired by the last pinch of opium, had driven me to this vandalism. But in the literal light of a new day, I could see no sense in the words I had left myself. Eversion, I said aloud, as if, like a spell, the meaning of the word might disclose itself through being spoken. But the significance was lost to my conscious mind. I felt that I ought to know what my own unconscious will had wrought, but there was nothing. Nothing except the assumption that, since inversion had been set down first and then angrily amended, the pressure of that crossing out had nearly been enough to gash the paper through to its other side. Then the two forms must have been similar enough to be confused in my mind. An image flashed before me. My drill penetrating Ramos, as in the trephination procedures, yet instead of wielding the brace, I was under the vault of his skull, a watcher from within, looking up to the ceiling of bone. Then the bone became paper, and the drill became a slicing nib breaking through from outside. A call sounded from above. A scuffle of footsteps signalled some urgent but doubtless routine business. The ship heaved about, timbers groaning, as if, like some indolent mouser, it had become exceedingly comfortable lying just so and did not wish to be disturbed. The commotion, perfectly ordinary as it was, roused the coronel. I was glad of that, because it gave me something to think about besides myself. He yawned and forced open an eye.
Are you refreshed, Silas?
I recrumpled the paper ball and made a point of consigning it to the feeble little stove, which was all that served to warm my cabin. It was not lit now, but it soon would be. I am very tolerably refreshed, Coronel, I lied to him. And looking forward to what the day brings. I arrived on deck. The wind had eased, and although we remained anchored, the swell was not as nauseating as it could have been. The sea was more grey than blue or green, and the sun a paltry yellow smudge that had only deigned to lift itself a little above the line of cliffs. Small icebergs, if they could indeed be called icebergs, drifted past us and to the south in an amiable procession like white cattle seeking fresh pasture. The cliffs were mostly in shadow, with only the uppermost part of them catching any of the sun's direct radiance. It was enough, though, to afford a much improved view of the inlet and the water beyond it. The inlet was wider than I had feared by night, and the idea of going through it no longer seemed entirely preposterous. The cliffs, at least where they had been broken through at this point, formed a sheer-sided but narrow wall, about 400 feet high. The gap was about 200 feet across, 5 or 6 times wider than Demeter, and the narrowest part of the channel extended about 300 or 400 feet in from the sea, before widening out into the lagoon. It was, I realized, only the severe aspect of the cliffs which made the idea of going through the inlet troubling to the imagination. Had the cliffs been harbour walls, I would never have doubted that the passage was navigable. Von Voot, Topolsky and Dupin were by the wheel again. The captain and Master Topolsky were in easy, animated conversation about some aspect of the operation ahead of us. Von Voot was gesturing into the rigging with a sucking end of his pipe, pointing out sails and lines, Topolsky nodding like an eager student. Dupin had his angular head bowed, studying something in his hands, a little construction of paper, smudged with ink, which in turn made his fingers blue. "Good morning, gentlemen," I called out.
"Good morning, Doctor," Von Voot answered. "The coronel is satisfactory, we trust?"
"Yes, very well rested, which I think is more than we can say for Monsieur Dupin, who I did not think to see on deck."
"I am well enough," Dupin said, not lifting his attention from the paper object. It was a sort of ball or lantern made of folds, expanding and contracting like a bellows as he worked his fingers against the hinge points.
"Be sure Ramos is secure," Von Voot said. "The meter may move around a little as we thread the fissure, and we would not want him to fall."
"I shall do so. I sense that a decision has been reached."
"Indeed it has."
"The captain has satisfied himself that the passage is safe," Topolsky said.
"Those were not my exact words,"
the captain corrected.
"I have decided, after consulting with my officers, that the risks are no worse than sitting out here in this ice floe, which, as you will have noticed, is greater in concentration than it was yesterday. In the lagoon, I expect that we will not be so troubled by icebergs. By ice, perhaps, but that is a different problem, and I do not think the lagoon will freeze over until later in the season."
"You are satisfied that we can sail through that gap?" I asked.
"Sailing will be only a small part of it, Silas. I was just explaining to Master Topolsky that we will rely on the tidal flow more than the wind, which is likely to be unpredictable in the confines of that passage. But the tide comes and goes with regularity, and provided we have sufficient depth in the channel..."
I tried to stop my voice rising with alarm.
"There's a doubt about that?" "The rocks that once made up that cliff, the part that is missing, must have gone somewhere. We must trust that they have spread far from the breach, rather than lying just beneath the waters."
"I would hope we rely on something more substantial than trust," I said. Dupin looked up from his paper toy. His cap was jammed down over tufts of sweat-matted yellow hair.
"This has been discussed in your absence."
"Has it?"
"Our charts show deep enough waters. We have no reason to disbelieve them. As a precaution, soundings will be taken as we approach the channel."
"By which time we will be in the tide's grip?"
"We will anchor if the need arises,"
Dupin said unconcernedly.
"Lieutenant Murgatroyd has sent spotters to the masttops," Von Voot said. "They observed the tidal rush as it came and went, and the water showed no sign of disturbance by anything below."
"I am reassured," I said uncertainly.
"Don't concern yourself with these matters of seamanship code," Topolsky said, as if I were sticking my nose into someone else's private business. "All your unreasoning fears will dissipate once we are inside the lagoon and have rounded that headland."
I turned to Von Voot. "Dare I ask when the tide is next in our favor?"
"We will have raised anchor within the hour. We shall sail nearer to the cliff until the flow has us, then strike sail quickly. You are welcome to be on deck, of course, but I must warn you that there will be a great deal of commotion as we approach the inlet. Much activity, shouting, and a considerable mass of men moving around."
I smiled at his tact.
"You are worried that I will get in the way, although you are far too kind to say it." "No, but it is as well to mention that the work will require delicate coordination from the men, and there is a reasonable prospect of injury. Nothing serious, I hope. The men are well trained and careful, but if ever your services were likely to be required, this will be the occasion.
I nodded, half filled with trepidation, half with the tingling anticipation of honest work.
Let us pray for nothing more than a dislocation or a simple fracture easily set. I will make sure the table is prepared for any eventuality. I think Coronel Ramos may be persuaded to take a chair, if I can stop him running up ladders.
We will be all right, Silas, von Voot told me. Demeter has always been a lucky ship.
Let us hope it remains so, I answered.